morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective on this Martin Luther King Day. Sitting across from me is
my cousin Tino,
and we have a full house today, Mike.
We do have a full house today. We want to, but we do want to honor Dr. King for a minute. Take a second and remember this day and the man, and he meant an awful lot to an awful lot of people.
I heard him speak live at a cathedral in St. Louis, and he was. And I'm an old guy now, I guess. He's the best speaker that I ever heard in my entire life. It was a stunning thing to be sitting in a church, awful lot of black folks there. I'd heard black preaching before, but I'd never heard anyone as good as Martin Luther King. And you know, I was very young, and after the speech, they passed the basket around because they needed money. And I was kind of like, we've been to this very elevated place, and suddenly then there's the practicality of raising money for the cause. And I was kind of like put off
young
by
people
it
are put off by that. They always are.
Yeah.
They want it pure.
They want it absolutely pure. And now I realize the absolute necessity of raising money at the speech for the cause that he was fighting for. But at the time I was really young, Mike, and I really was a purist, you know.
A lot of young people are that get involved in the causes. And a man that pointed out that if you don't educate people and you deny them like an opportunity, you deny them housing opportunity, and then you wonder why they're maybe not thriving as much as other ethnic groups. The conspiracy theorists believe that that J. he was killed during the Hoover era, that he was eliminated because he was pointing out how wrong black people were treated in America.
I had never seen as many white people and black people together at one event in my life. And I still haven't seen that. It was really huge. And it really was black and white together. It was really multi-ethnic and everything that things are supposed to be, and a stunning event. What's our program today, Mike?
We got a really good program. We got a hot topic here, hot local topic, El Rojo Grande. We have a couple of guests. We have John Black, who's going to tell us about himself in a minute. We have Ernie Stroh, who's going to tell us about himself in a minute. And we're going to talk at length about the recent victory, if you want to call it that, at the Yavapai Planning and Zoning Commission, the 7.5-hour meeting. But first, John, tell us about yourself.
Well, as you said, my name's John Black. I've lived in Arizona for 65 years. I enjoy the outdoors. I really enjoy living in Sedona. I'm a rather recent arrival, been here 4 years. My background, I've done a lot of different things. I started out as an electrical engineer, and I got, after about 15 years of that, I started a publishing company for engineers, technical publishing. And then I moved on to teaching at the university, Arizona State University. So I've got a background in engineering and computer science.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
We'll say that John's articles on this controversy are brilliantly written. They have an engineer's kind of systematic presentation. Plus, you really did a incredible amount of research.
Well, let me jump on this. He did 10 sections in 70-plus pages of research into the El Rojo Grande issue. And the sections range from the character of the neighborhood to going back to the 2000 P&Z meetings and the impact on traffic and all of these aspects of building this little city that Equity Lifestyles wanted to build out here and still does, by the way. Because we're right in the middle of things, so you're going to hear us,
folks. If you're tuning in from the internet or something, this is a very, very local issue, but it's a local issue that's going to reverberate all over the not only the country but the world. So let's introduce Ernie. Mike, go ahead.
Ernie, take it away.
Okay. I'm Ernie Strau. I'm a 21-year resident of Sedona, came from Southern California, where my background was in marketing. We called it soft marketing, and that definition relates to marketing considering the customer first. And so that was my background. And John and I happen to make a great team because he gets into the technical part and I get into the organizational,
Ernie and his wife, Karen, are longtime Sedona activists.
Right.
Ernie served on the Sedona City Council.
Right.
And has been active in everything that I've been in, back in 15 years in Sedona. I've seen you, I've seen you like a 100 times, even if I didn't say hello. You know, there you were.
Well, I, you know, started activism within probably the first 2 years on the Highway 179 issue that I was vice president of Voice of Choice, then ran for council because that seemed to be the only way you could change what the ADOT plan was. I've also served on the Sustainability Commission, mm-hmm. and sustainability has been one of my aspects, and that's frankly why I'm involved in this particular process.
So, Mike, where should we start on this? It's a bit of a complicated, or it's not so much complicated, it has so many different aspects. Maybe that is complicated.
I first want to say that sustainability, as far as the keyword goes, is, and the guests that we have in the studio, it is the transition word from between generations and between activists. The millennials that come in here that want to preserve the world, or at least preserve Sedona regarding climate change, all of these other things. Sustainability covers both ends, both all the guests that we have, all the activists that we have on here. I'm going to change myself to an inactivist, by the way, because I did not go to the Women's March on Saturday. yes, so we'll talk about it. But, John, lay this out for us. Start at the beginning, please. What's everybody upset about regarding El Rojo Grande?
Well, I think in order to really appreciate how passionate people are, you really have to know something about the ranch. I could give you a little background on that. The Planning and Zoning Commission basically focuses on land use, and that involves looking at maps and talking about issues that involve how to develop the land and so forth. But El Rojo Grande just isn't another piece of land.
Right.
If you've never visited the ranch, you kind of have difficulty understanding why people are so passionate about saving it. Earlier in the planning and zoning process, commissioners planned a field trip to the ranch.
Ah.
And I think their intention was to try and figure out why people were so passionate about it. Unfortunately, they weren't able to take that field trip. I don't know how many of them individually went to visit the ranch after that. The uniqueness of the ranch really starts with the creek that zigzags through the ranch. Dry Creek is not a dry creek. It's a seasonal stream, and it's fed by a rather large watershed to the north and the west of Sedona. That large watershed is mountainous, has chaparral, pinyon pine, juniper, woodlands, all prone to wildfires.
It's an area I've hiked in many times. We hike along Dry Creek, and so it's a very sensitive area because it is so the water coming down is secondary, and sometimes it's massive and sometimes there's nothing there. Traditional or typical Arizona stream in a lot of ways.
The watershed for Dry Creek is rather fire prone, and we had some experience this fall. Basically, when the fire started up there, and there was a big fire that started in the fall, and the Forest Service basically decided that since it was started by lightning and didn't threaten any structures or anything, they just decided to let it burn out naturally. And as a result of that, a large part of the watershed was burned off. And so then we had an event here when we had a big rain. I don't know if you recall when the hurricane came up from Mexico. And we had pretty heavy rain onto the watershed. And what happened was we had a torrential flow in the creek.
It really has reorganized the creek in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. If you hike along the creek, as I do, it looks very, very different. The trails have been had to be rerouted. It's in the 15 years I've been hiking in Dry Creek, that was the most massive change I've seen to the riverbed.
Yeah, when the water's really flowing, it's pretty much a raging torrent, and it pushes sand and rocks and trees and boulders, and these intermittent flash floods really reshape the terrain around the creek.
So let's say that the ranch is not inside the Sedona city limits. Ernie, how far is it from the city limits?
We have heard several statements. One, I think probably the most accurate is about 2.5 miles. We've heard 1.8. I've even heard 0.7. It's beyond 0.7, but
it's sort of like when people ask me when I was a tour guide, how long does it take to get to Phoenix? And I would say, well, it depends on which part of Phoenix you're going to. You know, we're talking about an hour and a half or 2.5 hours.
Right, but it's about up to 2.5 miles from Sedona city limits.
So this is a beautiful. This is a beautiful piece of land. That needs preserving, in your opinion? And
yes, NAU conducted a study in 2005, and they studied the birds and the butterflies and the plants and the flowers and so forth. And they found 83 species of birds on that land, 15 species of butterflies, and 250 species of trees and shrubs and cactus and grasses and so forth. And didn't include mammals. They didn't study the mammals. But you'll see on the mammal, you see cottontails, squirrels, and chipmunks, and pack rats, and coyotes, and javelina, and deer, and bats, and bats, and bats, just everywhere. So
listening to John Black, resident of the El Rio Grande area, and activist in the opposition to the rezoning of El Rio Grande. But I want to say, John, that the environmental, we're starting with the environmental stuff, and it certainly means an awful lot to a lot of people, but it doesn't necessarily mean squat to the Planning and Zoning Department of Yavapai County in that meeting that we just went to, that you just went to.
We have to announce when we started thinking about this, Mike, we didn't know that there would be this huge victory at the Planning and Zoning meeting, right?
Exactly. So jumping forward, that we've described the area a little bit, so at least we know what we're talking about. Right on our way between Sedona and Cottonwood, and I'm going to say up front that Mike Cosentino, Democratic perspective, liberal, snowflake, all the other words that they use for us, is not sure that this is sure, actually, that there's going to be lots of development between Sedona and Cottonwood. There probably should be lots of development between Sedona and Cottonwood. Everything that you described was Sedona and West. I moved here in 72. So I can go down West Sedona here and half of Uptown and tell you how many things were destroyed when they put in something. The fire department on Forest Avenue, the Hyatt. We can go on and on and on with things that were altered because of development. Now, El Rio Grande was a special place, I agree, and had special zoning considerations, which you're going to tell us about right now.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by zoning requirements, but basically...
Well, zoning issues.
Okay.
Somebody wanted to build...
Okay, they were talking about the rezoning request.
Yeah, let's get into it.
What was wrong with this particular project?
All right, okay.
As opposed, Mike's talking about development is going to happen. It has to be managed, yes. So forth and so on. But there was something particularly wrong with this project, right?
Yes, yes. Well, there were several topics that I basically researched in this. One of them was the traffic issues coming into Sedona. When you add that many people just outside of Sedona, it's going to increase the traffic greatly.
How many people?
Well, there's 650 units. We can get into the actual numbers later, but basically 600 manufactured homes were planned. People have argued anywhere between 1.5 to 2 people per home there. So 600 people, you'd have 1,200 people if you had 2 per home. So 1,200 people. That's about 1/8 of the population of Sedona.
Wow.
So you're really talking about, as they said, building a little city right outside the city limits.
Right. And your point, and we'll say it now, was no services. It's not in the city limits. It's this entity that needed all the services. They needed a place at the shop. They needed fire protection. They needed police protection.
Yeah, so, one of the city council members, when the ELS did its presentation in front of them to explain what they were going to do, said, you're basically building a small town outside of the city limits, and they're going to think they're part of Sedona. And yet you don't provide any services for this town. I mean, most towns have a gas station, maybe a grocery store, you know, drug store, something to support the people locally. These people are going to have to leave the development and drive into either Sedona or Cottonwood for everything they, every small need that they have.
Right.
So it's not really planned as a community so much as it is a large,
they're going to sell it as being in Sedona. I mean, just figure.
Absolutely. Well, they've added Sedona to the name for that reason, yes.
Right. And while we're on the subject of traffic, so we all know that Sedona's number one concern among the populace is congestion and traffic. And so the city is spending $35 million over a 10-year period to address traffic and hopefully attempting to reduce the current traffic we have by about 8 to 10%. So here comes this, after we're doing and committing all that funding, we raised our property tax, or I'm sorry, the sales tax by 0.5% to cover that. And then along comes ELS and it's going to add that exact same number back, making all of our efforts essentially worthless.
So, Ernie, was Sedona in favor of this, the city of Sedona government?
Oh, gosh, no.
Did they write a letter?
Yes, they did. Okay. And they were asked by Yavapai County to provide their recommendation.
Oh, good for the
county.
And
so they had a discussion in council. We didn't vote on it because we have no authority to deal with that
right.
as a city. But every single one of the councilors and the mayor expressed their opinion, and they were all 100% negative and directed the city manager to send a letter to in that regard to the county as their recommendation.
Okay, so getting into this, the development and the opposition to it. So as Steve and I have mentioned on previous shows, we have seen, we have rarely seen in the 7 years that Democratic Perspective has been on the air, anything that has drawn this many local people and this, for that matter.
Tell us about the meeting.
Quality.
The
quality
there.
Of the opposition has been outstanding. John's white papers here, we're talking section after section, including when he got to, and I want to, we're going to bring this up, if not now, later. We do want to talk about the planning and zoning meeting, because this was the opposition's, as Ernie mentioned, the first, before we had the show, a victory, a celebration. So we're celebrating that the planning and zoning, Yavapai County, turned down the zoning request of ELS, of the developer. They've turned it down.
Unanimously, Mike.
Unanimously. Yeah. And John did the research the last time that something out there, and this is part of it, I think, that had a big impact. John, I'm guessing that your research from 2005, when they voted 6-1 to deny the rezoning of Sedona Pines, had a huge impact on them. Go ahead.
Well, one of the arguments that I've made is that you need to be consistent in rezoning, especially. You need to take into account what kind of precedents were set in the past. And in this particular case, there's a smaller ranch, a 10-acre ranch just north of Sedona Pines. In 2005, Sedona Pines requested a rezoning of that property to a PAD zoning. And the purpose
Planned
was...
Land area development.
Yes. The purpose was to build a high-density development there. And there's the similarities are actually very striking. They, for example, they wanted to put a wastewater treatment plant on... In the development, they wanted to. Of course, they had to come up with some water. They, when you look at the list of things that they wanted, they agreed to put a traffic signal light at Red Moon Drive. These are all things that ELS has in their proposal too. So it's kind of a deja vu experience to read this new development.
Well, that's it, John. You pointed out in your letter that the similarity between what was being proposed was incredibly similar, and the opposition at the time in 2005 was incredibly similar for the same reasons.
If you hear the reasons that they gave for not wanting the development, they were very, very similar to what we're hearing now.
And I have to admit, for an engineer, you wrote this wonderful narrative called The Case of the King Ranch Rezoning, and this is what the area that Sedona Pines wanted to rezone at the time. Now, just to make sure, that area is now 2 acres, single-family home zone, 3 of which are occupied, 2 of which are not, 2 are still completely undeveloped. So rather than 64 timeshare units on there, there's 5 single-family homes, as was the original. Once again, there's development versus, having a your neighborhood very nice. But it was very successful in 2005. It was also successful in 2019.
Well, the vote of the commission at that time was 6-1. It was near unanimous against the proposed development. And the land was then subsequently subdivided into 5 residential properties, which average about 2 acres per property.
If you live in Sedona, you could feel the opposition building up really powerfully. And it came to the wave really hit with the planning and zoning meeting recently. And you had a substantial victory there. Tell us a little bit about it. Mike was there, and both of you were there. And
Mike wasn't
there. You weren't there? Oh, Michael. And it was a huge meeting, and an extraordinarily long meeting. Mike says 7.5 hours. I heard it was 8.5 hour long meeting.
Yes. There is one thing I'd like to clarify.
Please.
Mike, you mentioned the likelihood of additional development between Sedona and Cottonwood.
Yep.
There is a problem with that. I don't think it's going to happen because this happens to be the only private property on that area, virtually along 89A until you get to the Immaculate Conception Church just before Cornville Road at Verde Santa Fe.
That's true.
Okay. So that is really, that area should be, it's all Forest Service owned.
And state trust land.
And a little bit of state trust land, but not that much. It's mostly Forest Service. Anyhow.
I want to encourage people to go to the Yavapai County Interactive Site. It's one of the coolest things Yavapai County has.
Okay.
And they've had it for 15 years, by the way. They were way ahead of the curve. So give the county its props on its interactive map site. But you can click all the way down 89A, and if you bring it up correctly, then you can see who owns the land. Just by clicking on your computer, you'll see this is state trust land, this is Forest Service land, this is owned by Steele Family Trust, and so on and so forth, all the way between. So you can judge for yourself Ernie's estimate of not much or Mike's estimate of not much. But go ahead, tell us about the P&Z meeting.
Okay, so we realized that the idea was, in order to make a logical, consistent, and comprehensive discussion in opposition, and only being given 2-minute segments each, we had to write basically a 2.5 hour presentation and then break it up into 2-minute segments and have a different person. Obviously, you couldn't do more than 1 2-minute, for the whole meeting. So that ended up taking 53 people.
A very clever thing to do because of the limitations.
That was kind of, we still have a problem with that in the sense that the developer had the right to do a PowerPoint presentation and show videos. And we asked for that because we thought that would be
more impactful.
And we were turned down. No, we can't do that. So we said, okay, John and I got our heads together and said, look, We can still do a PowerPoint, but we'll do it printed out, and we'll give them this book of the slides, but we don't want them reading information. We want them to just get a glimmer of what that speech is about, and then we have the speeches that he and I wrote that now we had to recruit 53 people to do that, which we did.
A wonderful organizational skill.
My wife.
Oh, is that right? Oh,
she has been involved in after the march activities and the indivisible groups. I had the KSB background and contacts. And so we utilized a hundreds of person email list of our personal own friends and contacted people, and anyone who was in town said yes.
Well, that's what was so amazing is that from our standpoint, as Steve and I, the level of cooperation. You know, we've seen movements and people try to do things in this town and other and the world before, right, in the state, but you guys did it so well and did it so quickly. And you did it, so it was just organized in such ways.
Yeah,
you
got second.
And another point on that is I realize we're on Democratic perspectives, but there was never any issue whatsoever.
Right.
Whether, you know, the people who spoke were of one political leaning or another. The community came together as interested in this particular issue, united in absolute opposition.
Another interesting aspect is that this movement really gathered momentum. We had a very wide spectrum of ages involved in this, and that allowed us to use things like emails and texting and social media, such as Facebook, as well as letters to the editor, and we built a website. So we really made use of technology to get the word out, to communicate to people all about this. And then later in the process, when Ernie and I put together this presentation, we were able to contact people and get them to volunteer to read for 2 minutes so that we could set this all up.
This is a bipartisan effort, as it often is. Anything in Sedona when it comes to environmental or education, the citizens often respond in a bipartisan way. However, Republican perspective would not have had you guys on as guests on their show. Just want to point that out. Go ahead, John. Okay.
But no, I will just reinforce what Mike said. This was to us in Sedona, who lived in Sedona quite a while, it was extraordinarily well organized effort. It was a sort of a genius organization of this. And I'm sure you had as many Republicans as Democrats involved in this. But you don't know.
We don't know.
In 7 years, we never ask anybody what their party affiliation is when they come on the show. We often don't know.
Steve doesn't.
Mike checks him out, and the door is locked sometimes if you're a Republican trying to come on the show.
Well, the important point is there were 300 people that showed up, and you don't even get that number at a city council, a hot topic area at city council. So to have, and it wasn't even a board of supervisors, a planning and zoning commission meeting, they had never heard or seen anything like this happen in their entire, political career.
I think the huge turnout was a large factor in the unanimous vote.
Yeah.
Of the council. A couple of them commented, as Ernie said, that they'd never seen this kind of turnout, and they couldn't ignore it. Could not ignore it.
I have heard from county people between then and now, and it was absolutely a factor.
So the key was to make people aware of all the factors, and different people have different concerns, but we kind of covered the spectrum. And that really brought out the people.
You kept the opposition broad. Some were people were environmental. Some people were concerned about traffic. Different focuses.
Yes.
You kept it open to everybody. You didn't ask them any of their political affiliations. You just focused on this issue. But you let people what issues resonated with particular people. You combined all of that.
Yeah, it was kind of a multidimensional approach. Different people have different concerns, and we wanted to make sure everyone had the facts. As far as what they were concerned.
It certainly worked well.
Before we run out of time, I want to talk about workforce housing. This was sold by the developer and by a lot of other people that agreed with it. at least at first, and would have had impact on the county, strong impact on the county, in its decision. Talk about the fallacy of workforce housing.
Well, the Sonoma City Council was asked to comment on this, and Mr. Jarvis, who was representing ELS, put a lot of emphasis on workforce housing. And at one point he was asked, what do you consider affordable? Because this is a big question. And he said, and I quote him, the purchase price for a really nice manufactured home is in the $100,000 to $130,000 range. If you buy one of those units and you put it on the site and you pay a monthly fee of $980 a month, I would define that as compared to Sedona very affordable. So I decided to sit down and do an analysis. What would you have in terms of an income in order to be able to get a home in this new development? First of all, you'd need to get a $115,000. That's halfway between the $100,000 and $130,000. So you need a mortgage for $115,000.
Right.
Typically, you know, if you want to stretch it out, you'd make that a 30-year mortgage. In the case of a manufactured home, a normal home, a stick-built home, would be maybe a 4% mortgage. With a manufactured home, it typically runs about 7%.
Wow.
So if you figure that out, you're going to end up with a monthly loan payment of about $765. And so now you have to add in the $980 rental for the land, and you'll probably need about $85 for insurance. So you end up with a total monthly cost of about $1,830. Okay. That comes to about $22,000 a year. So now, a lender typically...
And there's taxes and so on.
No, taxes are being paid by the ELS. Okay. Yes.
In Sedona Shadows, the taxes are actually paid by the homeowners as part of their rent.
I see.
But most lenders typically don't want to see you go beyond 30% of your income far as your limit. So if you take that $22,000 and you say, if that's 30% of your income, how much income would you need to qualify for the mortgage? And it turns out it's $73,000. So when you talk about workforce housing or affordable housing, those are two words that are used sometimes interchangeably. If you go to Wikipedia, they'll tell you basically that means it's affordable for the person with a median income in the area. So I got online and checked out federal statistics and so forth, and they say that the median income for Yavapai County is about $46,600. So there's a big contrast between that $46,000 and the $72,000.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends in the service industry, and I don't know many of them. Oh, let me say any of them that are making $73,000 a year. And I take that back. Maybe a waiter that's been at Enchantment for 10 years and works 50 hours a week might be making $73,000.
Well, typically they get somewhere between $12 and $15 an hour.
Yes, well, we're talking tips here.
But the development was billed as a... 55 plus, and they were going to. I think is it a federal rule they have to have 20% or what?
Mr. Jarvis spent a lot of time talking about the fact that the federal laws or regulations allowed them to have up to 20% of the homes where no one over 55 was living there. But if you look at the contract that they use for Sedona Shadows, they require that there be someone 55 or older in each of the homes there in Sedona Shadows.
The other thing that Sedona couldn't consider that you did such a wonderful job on was the ELS rules and proposals, how they run their mobile home parks, or in this case, their manufactured home park. The deck is really stacked, as far as I'm concerned, against the resident.
Tell us a little bit about your research about what the company is. It owns hundreds of these things, right, John? Mm-hmm.
Yes, they do. They own almost 200 mobile home parks. Most of these are mobile home parks. They purchased them over a period of 20 years, and I went back through all their annual reports, looked at the dates of each purchase, and they also, and as part of their annual report, they record the occupancy of that particular park. So the question that really came up in my mind is, have they ever actually built any manufactured home parks or mobile home parks for that matter? And if you go back through the last 20 years, you look at all of the parks that they own today, you look at the dates at which they were bought, and then you go back to that annual year report and check to see what the occupancy was. The average occupancy was over 92%. So basically they were buying these parks, and I could find no evidence whatsoever in any of their annual reports that they have ever developed a park from scratch, as they're proposing to do here.
Equity Lifestyles, in John's research, as he said, owned about almost 200 mobile home parks, but they had another 200 RV parks. And we want to kind of, all of this stuff becomes important, parsing, you know, the difference between a trailer park and a mobile home park and a manufactured home park all becomes important if you're trying to borrow money, by the way, and other things. But certainly they proposed, just to be clear, they proposed a manufactured home park out here, at least mostly. But they also wanted 130 spaces to
be an
RV park.
I wanted to ask Mike before I'm going where you're going, but is there any control? You say it's about almost $1,000 a month rent. Mm-hmm. Is there any control on the amount of rent that they can charge?
No, the state of Arizona does not regulate rents in mobile home parks or manufactured home parks.
And they say they can raise the rent to whatever the market can bear. Right.
They made that point very strongly at the meeting.
So Ernie, there's no control. I mean, they could just, once you get on their property, you don't own the property. You own the manufactured home, right?
Yes, that's key, because the people who have purchased their homes, they really do not have a total right to live there over time. I think the longest, John, you can confirm this, about the longest contract anyone has is about a 3-year contract. And most of them are actually, or at least the recent ones, as I understand it, have been a 1-year lease. So consequently, if you're, and John has pointed out in his white paper, that we have a 200% increase in rent from the time someone first moved in there about 20 years ago to today.
Oh, way more than that.
That's like three times.
Well, I looked at the Sedona Shadows rent, basically to see, and again, I took this out of their annual reports. They report the annual rental on their lots within Sedona Shadows, and you can track it over a 20-year period. So you can literally plot how the rents have gone. And basically, they've increased the rent by 200%. So it's three times what it was at the
time. I can't do the math, but I'm looking at your chart. It went from $267 to $980.
Yes. That's average for the park. And that rate, actually, if you look at the percentage of increase, they have raised it about four times the rate of inflation.
And that's what the column he had on the chart I just gave you, Steve, that they had the rate of inflation is in the last column. But I want to argue with the engineer's math, but 267 in 1987 and in 2019, 980 seems like more than 200%, seems like four.
Well, it's 200% increase over that.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So
thank you.
So that aside, the point is, you have your modular home on this site. You maybe own your modular home.
Right.
But moving your modular home, if you don't want to pay the rent increases, is a problem?
Right. So what happens is that as someone's rent increases, and when you start with someone 55 and older, it isn't too long before they're retired and end up on a fixed income. And now your rent continues to go up. There will be, in many, many cases, instances where you are just priced out. You cannot any longer afford to live there. Now, John can tell you, because he's talked to a lot of the people, what happens to individuals in current recent circumstances who have been exposed to that.
I don't have the hard data like I do on some of this other stuff, because the mobile homes in Arizona are treated as personal property. It's like a cell phone. It's bought and sold. There's no record of the sales prices of these properties, so of these homes. And so ELS knows. They actually buy most of the homes back from the homeowners when they can no longer afford to rent. So they have a complete listing of what they have paid for the homes. There is a clause in the contract that if the owner finds someone to buy their mobile home, they're required to go to the office and talk to the ELS person and tell them we have an offer for $8,000 for my $90,000 trailer. And then ELS has the option, and it's a clause in their rental contract, to buy it for that price. So ELS is able to purchase these properties.
And just in case the residents forget, there's a sign on the property to remind them
yes.
that they can't sell their mobile home without checking with the manager.
Right, and then they're in a much better position to sell the modular home for a higher price, right, than an individual who's trying to get out of there because the rent's too high.
Well, Ernie mentioned that the longest contract that he knew of was 3 years. I have seen one for 5 years.
Have you?
But the point being that you're really in a spot. If you can't pay the rent, if you're no longer able to afford the rent, you have to get rid of the trailer one way or the other. You either have to find a buyer for it. If you can't find a buyer, then there's a clause in the contract. If you abandon the trailer, which you can do, I mean, that's you walk away from the rent. Maybe you've got a contract and you got to pay for 2 more years. You can walk away, but the clause in the contract says they can then claim the trailer and resell.
Let's talk. We've got four minutes left. Let's talk about what happens next. You had the big victory at planning and zoning, but the fight's not over yet, right?
Correct.
What's happening?
Yeah. On February 20th, same place, Cottonwood offices, county offices, 6th and Mingus. Actually, the address is 10 6th Street in Cottonwood. The supervisors will deal with this issue one more time. Now, some of us are maybe dreaming a little, but hope that ELS will see the handwriting on the wall and say, you know, this has so much local opposition and there's no way to make a silk purse out of the sow's ear here, so we will, you know, they might drop it. However, we can't, no way can we count on that. So the plan is we will regenerate our effort using similar tactics, not exactly the same. They will be revised to fit into the concepts that the county supervisors take into account that are much broader than the very specifics that P&Z deals with. They have an ordinance that they have to comply with, tells them what they should and should not consider in their decision. The supervisors don't have that limitation. They can consider anything. So we have to broaden our scope to be able to deal with virtually anything.
Yeah, and that's an important distinction, by the way. The P&Z does their job. They did it. They voted unanimously against it. The Board of Supervisors is now going to do their job, and they have different criteria.
And how can people find out about this meeting if they want to go to it?
Well, I would suggest that they go to our website. Basically, it's elrojograndesedona.com. And all of the information that you need, including the schedule for all the meetings, is right there.
If you want to get involved, that's what you should do.
Yeah, right? Go to elrojo.com.
Elrojogrande.com.
We will have this episode up on our website in a couple of days. We do want to mention before we sign off that the Democrats of the Red Rocks annual meeting is coming up January 27th from 4 to 6:30 at the St. Andrew's Episcopal Church, 100 Arroyo Pinion Drive. If you want to get more involved in lots of things, check out Democrats of the Red Rocks. They have a local office. They're having their annual meeting at the St. Andrew's Episcopal Church. Katie Hobbs will be there, one of my favorite people. Secretary of State of Arizona Felicia Rolini will be there, chair of the Democratic Party, again, one of my favorite people, and Deidre Abood, who's running for vice president of the Arizona Democratic Party, and Felicia French. All of these fantastic women will be at the DOOR annual meeting. The DOOR breakfast is this week, Thursday, and you might want to come to that at the Old Sedona Bar and Grill. You want to pick up a Democratic perspective on
it was last week. Yeah,
you can talk to somebody who was at the meeting and find out all the wonderful things that happened at the DOOR breakfast. We want to remind you that Democratic perspective is carried on VVID.org, bbidea.org. We are live streamed all over the world. You can find 780 Chasm website and listen to our show if you are in Timbuktu. Thanks, folks.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.